Thank you. My name is Gay Garner, and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
Grateful to be sober, and another wonderful opportunity for Al and I to be with members of Alcoholics Anonymous and members of Al-Anon at a wonderful retreat like this weekend. Al, stand up. They're going to get to hear you tomorrow, but I just want to know them to know tonight who I'm speaking about. I want to thank the committee so much for having Al and I up here, and it's just wonderful. Al's story is as much a miracle as mine is, and it's always wonderful. When I got sober, it was very much about the family and the illness of the family. Of course, about the individual illness, but also collectively about our families. And that's very much what it is for me today. So to have the opportunity to share on a program with Al is always just a great, great blessing. I heard a guy say on a tape one time, I can't think of any place I'd rather be with people I'd rather be with talking about what we talk about. And we talk about recovery, and we talk about unity and service. And it has been an absolute awesome experience for me. I tell you, there's a lot of local people here that I don't know, and part of that reason is I've been very active in service over the years, and it's really taken me traveling. And I have not been able to be active locally as much as I would have liked to have been, but I've just rotated out of being the trustee for the Southeast, so that opportunity has presented itself for me. So I hope I'll be seeing you at meetings and things like that. And other people, the lady from Tucker. I live and work in Tucker, and so I'm anxious for that to happen. It's on a rotation was not the easiest thing for me. It really surprised me. I thought it was going to be a piece of cake because I believed in the principle so much, but it was a little bit more difficult than I thought it was. And so I've been really back into doing all those initial things that I did when I got sober, and I was trying to feel a part of again, you know, going into a meeting and hugging somebody and telling them I loved them and I cared about them, and going when I didn't feel like going and chairing meetings and doing all that stuff. So I'm beginning to get my feet a little bit back on the ground. And these last 2 weekends, we were up at Rough River last weekend, and here has just really helped me so much to just be in small groups with just doing AA stuff, and I have just loved it, and I really appreciate that opportunity. Through this wonderful process of inventory that, you know, our literature says wise men have always known to do, which was something I never knew to do, everything important in life, you know, that I have learned in listening to people share about their lives and in meetings where we talk about, you know, the principles of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's given me the tools to go and live. I never knew how to do this. I came from a family that had a lot of money, a lot of social standing. I had a lot of opportunity. I had a chance at a wonderful education, and I knew absolutely nothing about how to live or how to have a relationship with other people. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given me that, and I will be forever grateful for that opportunity. Also, I want to take this opportunity to thank the Al-Anons that are here, because I really know that Al and I would not be together today if it were not for the program of Al-Anon. And Al is a wonderful Al-Anon, and he talks to me about Al-Anon all the time, and he reads to me from the Al-Anon literature. And I'm here to tell you, he has helped me so much with the problems in my family with my children. And, you know, I'll be at work, and the phone will ring, and it'll be Al, and he will be reading me something from Courage to Change or One Day at a Time or something. And it's been a great help to me, and I've been in my refrigerator has a lot of AA stuff on it, but and pictures, you know, from the grandchildren and all that wonderful stuff. And I've got a little place where the Al-Anon stuff is, so it has been just a wonderful, wonderful thing for me to have the opportunity to share in both of those programs. As I'm able to, through this process of inventory, to look back on my family, it's allowed me to discover a lot of things about my family and about myself. I came from an alcoholic family, and there were a lot of things that went on that I didn't understand. When I began to get sober, then I could put those pieces of the puzzle together and come up with a little bit about what was going on. I came from a wonderful family. They were alcoholic. Well, you know, I heard a guy say the other time, you know, at the early stages of our alcoholism, we sort of make everybody else look beige, and that's kind of the way it is, you know. And they were charming, and they were wonderful, and they were loving, and they were caring. And they also was, my story about my family is not a lot about what I hear from the podium about alcoholics. in their practicing time. My mother affectionately referred to herself as a lush, and my dad affectionately referred to himself as a drunk. They were terms of endearment. They were not meant to be anything other than that. So, you know, they were not upgraded to words like alcoholic and things like that. But I grew up in that family, and they were very, my dad had a lot of money, so, you know, the needs that we had were met. We were brought up with principles. We were brought up to be responsible and all those things. My dad had become my drinking partner, and as I got sober in 1976, I watched him die of this devastating illness 2 weeks before my first birthday. He died of the illness of alcoholism. My brother, when I was 5 years old, at the age of 40, a beautiful artist and photographer and a wonderful young man, died as a direct result of alcoholism and drugs. I have another younger brother who has been hospitalized many times for alcoholism. He still practices today. He does not choose this way of life. He knows about it, as all my family knew about it. My father watched me get sober. My brother watched me get sober. This younger brother of mine has watched the wonderful transition in my life as I've gotten sober, and it does not choose to be his today. I have a younger sister who is a daily drinker, and it certainly looks like her life is going on the same path as mine has gone, and it is not their choice. I was given a great freedom when I got sober in AA. They told me the greatest gift I could give my family was to stay sober, to work the principles of this program, and to show them a better way if that would ever be their choice, and that their alcoholism and problems were between them and their higher power. And the only thing that I could do was just set an example. Al and I didn't set an example, a very good example, for many years, and we took a lot of sickness into our family, of which we take responsibility for, but that is not the way it is today. And we share with our family the love and the joy and the principles of the programs of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. And we talk the steps in our family all the time, and we've had wonderful opportunities to do that. I had a sponsor who told me that when I got sober, that I was going to learn a lot of wonderful tools for living, and then I was going to get a lot of opportunities to use those tools. And that has certainly been my experience. Al and I have three daughters. The oldest is a very healthy, wonderful young lady. The only one in our family, on both sides of the family, that we know that can live without having to go to a 12-step program of some kind. So she's been wonderful to watch. And that is not to say that she hasn't had problems, because she has had problems. Life has problems. But she has always dealt with them well. She has always had a power greater than herself in her life, and she always has seemed to know what to do, that we come to meetings to find out what to do. Our middle daughter, Lori, has been in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous for 19 years. We had her hospitalized when she was 16 for the first time, hospitalized on three different occasions. Al and I watched her children being taken away from her in a courtroom on two separate occasions. Her life has been just an absolute testimony to the devastation of this illness. Several marriages, her little family still has a lot of problems in it. She has two children. Her oldest daughter, who is 16 years old, has two babies. The youngest daughter, who is 14, is in a treatment facility run by the state of Georgia as a ward of the state of Georgia. She's been drinking and doing drugs since she was 11 years old. She is 14 years old now, so you can see our family continues in that path. So that's why it's so important for me. Service has been so important for me, because, you know, that's where I learn what to do so that Alcoholics Anonymous will remain as it is today and always be available for those who will need it. And I already have a 14-year-old granddaughter who's attending AA meetings along with NA meetings. Our youngest daughter, I have to tell you, Lori just had her first year birthday in AA. That is so important. On September the 29th, she celebrated 1 year. She went into a halfway house. She had a choice of jail or halfway house. She took the halfway house, which we were grateful for. And the miracle took place for her in that halfway house. And she's just doing beautifully now. And I have an opportunity to attend. We go to one meeting a week together and sit together and hold hands when the Lord's Prayer is said, and making up for all that lost time. And it's just been a glorious thing for me. And, you know, all during that period of time with the opportunity to sponsor young women, I never lost hope. I always knew that it would be there for her if she ever made, you know, that decision that was the way she wanted to go. So we're forever grateful for that. And her little family's doing a lot better, too. The little 16-year-old's back in school trying to get her education, and our little 14-year-old granddaughter will be out of the treatment facility 2 days before Christmas, so we are very grateful for that, too. Our youngest daughter, Allison, is a drug addict. She had 5 years in the program of Narcotics Anonymous. She did not go to AA. And that Narcotics Anonymous group that she attended believed as much in singleness of purpose as we do here. And she's been wonderful to watch. She's not been going to meetings, and we think she's in a lot of trouble. So our energies and our prayers are certainly with her at this time. As I look back about myself when I was a kid growing up, as I said, I was just crazy about my mom and dad, and I was crazy about my home. And it seemed like, you know, things were okay with me. The one thing that I do remember that went on in my home, and I remember it so well because I took that into my own home, and it was my means of control, and it was when things didn't go my way, and when people didn't do what I wanted to do, I shut down. Bill calls it silent scorn. It was in my family. I can remember that deadly silence when you weren't doing what somebody wanted you to do, and everybody just shut down. They shut down their affection, they shut down their connection with you, they shut down their support, everything shut down. And I can remember that deadly silence and just wanting to do anything to get out of that. And that's the same thing that I did with my family. When things didn't go well, I shut down. And I have to be very careful today because my pattern is if I get my feelings hurt or if things don't go the way I want them to go, my tendency is to shut down. So I have to work on that all the time. I did very well in school. I lived in a fantasy world. Back in those days, I lived in the movies. Kids lived in the movies. They were wonderful. They had happy endings. And it was the ultimate escape to just go spend many times to go to the movies in the daytime and then go get a bite to eat and then go back to the movies and then go get dinner and then go back to the movies again. We just lived in the movies. And they were wonderful. People sang to each other. It was the great era of the musicals, and it was just a wonderful time. And I read a lot. I read a lot of true romance magazines and true confession magazines, which were very popular at that time. So I had kind of I was talking to somebody tonight about those old ideas. I had a lot of old ideas about the way I thought things were supposed to be. And I really, truly believe that people just went off and kind of found their soulmate, you know, got married, and lived happily ever after. And really, as a kid growing up, that's really all I ever wanted to do, was just find the right guy, get married, have a family, and live happily ever after. It was realized for me at the age of 18, I had a musical ability that was far above average, and I had been into a lot of activities in school. And I wanted to go to New York and study music, and that was realized for me. So at the age of 18, I left Omaha, Nebraska, and went to the big city of New York and enrolled in Juilliard School of Music and Columbia University to, make my way in life. And it became really the first resentment that I had. And from as I look back on that period of time, I guess I was very well protected. I had an innocence and a naivety about me that I still seem to have today, and it doesn't serve me very well most of the time. But I just, it was just a wonderful time, and I don't remember a lot of problems. I do know today that about my inabilities to form a true and lasting relationship, as our literature talks about. I left Omaha at the age of 18 to go to New York. I had been with these kids all of my life, school, Sunday school, church, camps, everything. And I left there, and I was never to have a connection with one of those kids until I went back to the class reunion 30 years later. And many of them said to me, well, we wondered, I had been, you know, voted the most talented and one of the most likely to succeed and all that kind of stuff. And they said, you know, we wondered what happened to you. It's just like you fell off the face of the earth. But I did. I fell off the face of the earth, and I went somewhere else, and this was just sort of a closed door for me. As I look back on Alice in my life, there were always a lot of people. We were surrounded by a lot of people. But when we left areas where we moved, there was never a connection with anybody. We just left all the friends, people that we had associated with through, you know, some pretty long periods of time. There just was no interconnection with anyone. I got to New York. My life never went very well after this period of time. I think I pretty much had what I wanted, and things went my way, and so on and so forth. But things began to happen to me at this time. As I'm able to look back, I had carried a very deep resentment for my dad for years on this situation. I was 18 years old. This was back in the 50s, 56 to be exact. The world was a lot different back then, you know. We did not talk about things as we do today, and things were not in the open, and we were pretty well protected. But as I saw this experience, I got up there. I was very successful. I went to work immediately in cocktail lounges, and I was enrolled in school, doing very well. And as I saw it for many years, you know, I was doing well, and all of a sudden my father appeared and was to take me home. Several years ago, so I was pretty sober, at least 15, 17 years sober, I really realized what had happened in that situation. Young kid, thrown into the jazz world. I'm a jazz pianist. I was working. I was approached on several different situations about joining prostitution rings. I was offered drugs on a daily basis because it was very prevalent in the jazz world. I got myself involved with a married man. I did not know he was married at the time, and I found out through a series of situations, and my heart was broken. And all these situations, I found it necessary to share all this stuff with my mom and dad. So, you know, here's this 18-year-old kid from Omaha in the late 50s telling her parents that she's been approached by prostitution rings and drugs and involved with a married man. Next thing I knew, my dad was in New York, of course, you know. And we had one of those father and daughter chats, and he said that he thought that that was not the kind of life that I would like. And he wanted me to leave and come home with him and go to college and meet a nice young man and all that kind of stuff. And I bought the deal. It sounded pretty good to me, so I was to return home with him. The most significant thing about the New York thing was this is where drinking became a regular part of my life. I did not drink when I was a young teenager. It was offered to me at home. I didn't run with kids that drank. It was just not a part of my life. I had my first drink to have a drink in New York. I got drunk very quickly after that. On several different occasions, very same set of circumstances, I was going around with my agent auditioning for a job, was drinking, got drunk, got very sick, barely made it home. I was living with a very old maiden aunt, and got very sick when I got home, and she asked me what was wrong with me, and I told her I'd eaten something that hadn't agreed with me. So the significant thing for me in that is that I always lied about my drinking. From day one, it became necessary for me to always, when it wasn't even necessary to lie about my drinking. It was part of the deal for me. So as I'm able to look back in those early days, it seemed like I never just had a drink. Once that process started, I drank a lot. In the beginning, I had an enormous capacity to hold alcohol, and of course, as the progression of the disease went, my capacity to hold alcohol went also, and also the lying. So those are the things that were significant about my drinking from the very beginning. As I look back, it just seems like my life never went very well. It had its ups and downs, but on an overall picture, it never went very well during this period of time. I thought it was because my dad had not left me alone to pursue my career. And the truth really was that alcohol now was a regular part of my life. It was not a daily part, but it was a regular part. I loved the drinking. I loved what it did to me. I loved the way it tasted. I loved everything about it. I loved the places where you drank. Everything about it I loved. And it did for me for a long time what I wanted it to do for me in early times. I was to return home with my dad to Wake Forest, to Winston-Salem. He relocated in Winston-Salem. I enrolled in Wake Forest College. At that time was run by the Baptist State Convention, so there were a lot of rigid rules and regulations, and there was not a lot happening on campus. I immediately fell in with the four or five kids that drank on campus, and Al was a part of that group, so that's how I met Al. And he'll tell you a little bit more about that tomorrow. But anyway, our first date, he took me to the Plantation Supper Club in Greensboro, North Carolina. When we brown bagged it, North Carolina was a dry state, And we took our little bottle in a brown bag, and we danced to the music of Carmen Caballero. And it was a done deal at that time. And those early years were wonderful. Our education, Wake Forest, really became sitting in a little place underneath Winston-Salem called the Rathskeller, where they played jazz and they drank beer. And this is where we lived almost every night of the week. I got pregnant, and this became my second blaming board and a devastating time for me and my family. Back in those days, and my parents were very socially prominent, it was just a very unacceptable thing. It was a devastating thing for them. It was the first time I can remember having feelings of where I had really hurt someone, and there wasn't anything I could do about it. My success rate up until this time had been pretty good, and this was the first chink in the chain. And my dad cried. He was a very powerful person in my life, and I saw him break down and cry. My mother told me that I had broken her heart. When I got sober, I was able to see that these things were said in moments of sadness and frustration and not knowing what to do, never meant for me to carry him for 25 years in my life. But that's what we apparently do, and through the steps, I was finally able to put that situation where it needed to be, finally, after all those years. But it was a devastating time. I finally realized after I was 5 years sober that it might have been a tough time for Al. You know, that just wasn't in my thought process at that time. When I first got sober, when they talked about the selfishness and self-centeredness of the alcoholic, you know, many times I sat in many meetings and heard things talked about the alcoholic and would say to myself, thank God that's not my problem, only to realize as time went on that yes, too, you know, that was my problem. I had a sponsor told me to put my name on the top of every page in the big book. She says, you put your name up there because that's your story, that's about you. And of course, you know, having been able to maintain some sobriety for a while, I have found that everything in that book is about me. But I didn't think that I was selfish and self-centered because I would have given you anything I had. And if I didn't have it, I'd go find it so I could give it to you. But I didn't understand that inner selfishness that we have where, I mean, I couldn't see anybody except how they played the role in my life. So as far as Al was concerned, he just happened to be there. I couldn't see that, you know, it was taking him out of school. He was in his final year of law school at Wake Forest. It took him out of law school. He never, you know, returned to finish that. But, you know, I began to, fortunately, when I got sober, to see, you know, things apart from me. So it wasn't just me at the center of everything all the time. I don't think we were asked what we wanted. The marriage was arranged. We were married, it was arranged that we would go off to northern Florida to a little city by the name of Stark, Florida. I don't even think it was a city. It was so small. It was outside of Jacksonville. And that's where Al and I started our life together, and those were the circumstances that our life started under. And, of course, people had told me, you know, marriages under those circumstances never make it. So I was bound and determined to do everything I possibly could. And I really believed I could make this thing work. And of course, this became my obsession. I became absolutely obsessed with the idea of making this marriage work. It not working was never an option. Me leaving it was never an option. It was to hang in there until the bitter end to make this thing work. I almost was able to do that. Our life drinking was on weekends and partying. We drank a lot, and we drank all the time, but it was not daily at this time. I don't remember a lot of outside problems that I was having as a result from drinking, but I was certainly in trouble inside. I began to seek out things to make me feel better. The marriage was just, it was not like those wonderful relationships I was reading in true romance magazines. It seemed like the harder I tried to make it work, the worse I got. Back in those days and the times in which I came with, you didn't discuss those things with people. I mean, I came from a home that not only didn't discuss things outside the home, we didn't discuss things inside the home. So we just didn't talk about those kind of things. It was just that urgency of making it okay, trying to be enough. And of course, I never realized until after I got sober that it wasn't all my fault. I mean, I always thought it was my fault. Sometimes my story sounds like an Al-Anon, doesn't it? You know, that incessant need to pull that family together, to hold that family together. And as you'll hear from Al tomorrow, he's out doing all those things a lot of alcoholics do. So anyway, I started trying the churches. I had not come. I came from a wonderful family, but they didn't go to church on a regular basis. But I went to a church on a regular basis because a lot of the social events for the kids in the area that I was born in, all the social stuff was going on at the church. So I was there a lot, and I always kind of suspected there might be an answer there. Although it was very much like my first AA meeting and sitting in those Sunday school classes and listening to people talk about that and never really quite understanding what they were talking about and not being able really to take some of that stuff out and get it working in my life. I never had anything work in my life until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, the first time things began to work for me in my life. I tried all the major churches thinking maybe I could find an answer there, and I went to a few minor ones that no one had ever heard of thinking I might find an answer there. I know today about myself that, you know, if something doesn't work for me in 24 hours, I'm looking for something else. You know, I do not have that ability to stick with anything long enough to make it work. Although my sponsor says, no first step in that stuff, that's why. You know, you got to get someplace where there's a first step so something will work for you. Drinking, of course, as I drank, it progressed. I tried to do the self-help books. That was about the time the self-help books came out, and I tried to do some of the suggestions that they would have there. And once again, when it wasn't working in 24 hours, looking for something else. I did a lot of those things that women do. I could always get a new hairdo, get a new outfit. I always had a little bit of a weight problem, so there's always some program that I could go to and try to get some help there. But on an overall basis, I could never find anything that would make me feel okay inside. I didn't know until I got sober that what was wrong with me was wrong with me inside, and I didn't know that the healing that I needed had to take place inside. I had no idea. The drinking progressed. Al had an opportunity to take a job with an entertainer to set up some radio stations throughout the country, and he took it, and the first move was to be to Knoxville, Tennessee, which we lived there for about 3 years, and some things really began to happen for me at this time. The marriage never did ever have any kind of a healthy base. It just seemed to get worse as the drinking progressed. The worstness of the marriage progressed also, and some things happened for me at Knoxville. I was about 30 years old by now. We had 3 children, and I developed a terrible fear of nighttime. I have no idea where that came from. I have no experience. I think it's just part of the progression of and the fear that I was so encompassed with at this time. And it seemed like I could be okay in the daytime, but when the nighttime came, I was in really bad shape. Al fixed the locks. He was doing a lot of traveling. He was not home a lot. He did not know a lot about what was going on in the family. He reinforced the locks on the doors and the windows, and I began to even sleep with my children. They were very small at that time, but I began to sleep with guns and billy clubs and knives and all that kind of stuff. And I'm glad to report to you, since I've been sober, I have not had to do that. Anyway, Al used to say if anybody ever walked in that bedroom and see your arsenal, they'd have left immediately. But anyway, I don't know what I thought was going to get me, but I was just really prepared for it. I didn't know how to drive an automobile, and the marriage had gotten so bad at this time, and I am a very dependent person. Thank God AA has helped me put that dependency where it needs to be on God and AA as a whole, but I couldn't get it on Al because he was working on his own thing, so it went right back to my mom and dad, and I developed this relationship with my mother. We had sort of a mutual admiration thing going. My dad had lost all his money, and she had been thrown into a lifestyle she'd never been in before, so she was having some problems. And of course, with my marriage, and it was just like two magnets being drawn together, and we just sort of gave each other the validity for living. I would sit around and tell her how wonderful I thought she was and how important she was to me, and she would do the same thing with me. So she came up and taught me how to drive. I didn't know how to drive. It became important for me to do this. I had 3 small children, and Al was gone all the time. And so it was a very interesting thing in my getting sober, because until I got sober, I never drove over 25 miles an hour. I was so afraid of the automobile. And then I never only went to where the kids went to school, to the liquor store, to the bank, and the grocery store. And then I never went unless it was sun was out and it was broad daylight, and I was absolutely terrified. Well, when I got sober, of course, I had to drive at night, and I had to drive in the rain and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, my mom came up and taught me how to drive. The other thing that happened to me is I just became a daily drinker. As I'm able to look back at this time, even though my love for drinking and what it did for me most of the time was what I wanted it to do for me, I think I really began to drink differently at this time. I began to drink to ease. I found out that it eased the fear inside, it eased the loneliness, it made me not quite so upset that my father hadn't left me in New York. It made it quite not so bad that Al wasn't there and that our relationship wasn't what I had hoped it would be. But of course, the next morning I would wake up with all the guilt and the remorse and the hangover and all that stuff. So I began my daily drinking at this time. We moved on to Augusta for a while and then up to Baltimore, Maryland. By the time we got up to Baltimore, I was doing all those things that alcoholics do. I was buying liquor by the half pint. I was watering down booze. I was loading my drinks. I was sneak drinking. I was doing all those things. I got a call on Thanksgiving morning, be 24 years tomorrow on the 22nd of November, that my mother had died suddenly. And my world completely fell apart. And I fell apart with it. I had absolutely no tools, no means, no relationship with another human being or a higher power or anything like that. And I had just nothing to deal with this situation. I was just devastated. And my drinking, of course, progressed. And I was drinking pretty much around the clock at this time. I was able to go to Florida and take care of and help my dad with whatever we needed to, and then he was to come live with me and become my drinking partner. And what my patterns were at that time is I began to go to seances. I began to go to libraries and check things out of the library about how you reach people who have crossed over to the other side. And I had a box of letters that she had written me. And the box had a couple of old love letters from Al before we got married when things were good. And my piano teacher, who wanted nothing but success for me in New York, and letters from my mother, who wrote me almost every day about how much she loved me and how much of a success and how much she wanted my life to go well. So during the daytime, I would drink with my father, and we would talk about my mother and how fortunate we were to have had her and how we missed her. And I would pass out somewhere in the early afternoon hours, and then I would wake up when the kids would come home from school, take whatever care of whatever needs I could for them. And then after dinner, the heavy drinking into the hours of the night, reading the box of letters and trying these means by which to reach her. And this was to continue for several years. Some things began to happen to me. My hair all fell out. I got sores all over my body, and I started getting swellings in my throat and my feet and my hands, which were to lead me to a series of doctors and emergency wards and hospitals to try to find out what was wrong with me. I knew I drank too much. My family knew I drank a lot. There were comments about my drinking, but no one had any idea that drinking was playing such a major part in all of this. In the series of doctors, I just love it. They all thought I was allergic to something, but they couldn't ever seem to find out what it was I was allergic to. And of course, we all know what that is now. But anyway, I had all a series of tests and everything done. And they called Al and I together and said, you know, you're having a nervous breakdown. And the doctor said to me, you know, you're going to have to change. If you're going to make it out there in the world, you're going to have to change. Everything about you is going to have to change. The way you think, the way you act, everything. And I asked him, I said, well, how do I do that? And he just looked at me like one of those looks like, I should know how to do that. So I left the doctor's office knowing that there's some changes that needed to be made and having no earthly idea what I needed to do or how I needed to do it or where I could get any help. I was to go to Omaha shortly after that. My grandmother passed away, and I was to... the thing that is so significant about that, about the change and everything, is when I walked through the doors of AA, when it came my time to come here, you told me that that's what had to happen to me. We used to have a saying when I got sober, the person I was drank, the person I was will drink again. And that a lot of changes had to be made. And when I asked you how I you know, how I was going to do that. You said we have 12 steps of recovery that will help you bring about that change in your life so that you can live free of alcohol and live out in the world. And then, of course, all the wonderful promises that we're given when we do the work that's asked of us in the steps. And, of course, that has been my experience. But I left that doctor's office not having a clue of what was going on or what to do and had this opportunity to go to Omaha. I stayed with my piano teacher, and she and her husband had been longtime drinking friends of my mom and dad's. And he was sober 2 years in AA. And he did not tell me his story, but she told me his story. And he was the kind of drunk that had had a lot of jails and wrecked cars and institutionalized and things like that, which, you know, I was a housewife alcoholic, and I could not identify with the circumstances. But two things happened to me at that time, as I look back, that I know that really were to change my life as time went on. The first one was I was having a drink, and it was early in the morning, and that was not unusual for me because my family always drank early. His wife also was alcoholic, so for us to drink early in the morning was not unusual. He passed by, and he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, "There are no answers in that for us anymore." And I don't remember thinking a lot about what he said, but I remembered the night that I called the number in Atlanta for the answering service. The other thing was that he just kept touching me. Every time he went by me, he would squeeze my shoulder, or squeeze my hand, or touch my head, or just touch me. And I was just getting real nervous about that. I knew that something was going on, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. And, of course, after I got sober, we had a chance to talk about that, and that's just that wonderful physical, spiritual energy we give to each other when we hug and when we hold hands and when we touch each other. And that's what he was doing for me that visit. I came home and things were pretty bad. We had news that we were going to be moving to Atlanta. The job that Al had gotten involved in was having a lot of problems. The FBI had tapped our telephone, and the IRS had become almost family. every time we moved someplace, there was IRS to see us and talk to us, and there were a lot of lawsuits that had taken place, and our bank accounts had been attached, and cars had been removed from the driveway, and this is our Al-Anon. Cars had been removed from the driveway, and furniture had been removed, and there was just all kinds of a lot of problems along with the fears, the unknown fears that we have. So it was pretty bad. We got to Atlanta, and of course I had high hopes that things would get better, and of course when you're in the progression of alcoholism, things do not get better, and they got worse, and I got worse. And I think my recovery began very much like it's described in the 12 and 12. The bankruptcy was complete. I was so absorbed in myself at that time that I could see nothing beyond that. I think I had what they called an act of providence. I was sitting on the edge of bed with a loaded gun, getting ready to blow my brains out, because life had become so unbearable for me at that time. I could see nothing but to be out of it would have been some relief. I think I had that moment of truth. I set the gun down, I went in the bathroom, and I hear so many alcoholics describe from the podium. I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror, and the words that came out of my mouth are, "Oh God, what am I going to do?" And I went to the phone and called Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time I got the call back, and I know it probably wasn't that much time, but I had passed out. And one of the girls took the call and asked if, told them that I'd passed out and could they call me back the next morning. And they did. And I was to go to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in January of 1976. Now, that was not to be my last drink. But, of course, as we all know, you never drink very successfully after you've been to AA. And I just sort of felt, you know, for the next 3 months, kind of like I was on a tightrope. You know, some days I felt like I was alcoholic and I was right where I belonged. Other days I didn't feel like I was alcoholic. And on those days I didn't feel like alcoholic, it seemed necessary to have a few drinks. So my pattern was pretty much that way. There were no women in East Atlanta when I got sober, which is pretty unusual when you know today and you go to meetings and you sit there and sometimes there's more women sitting there than there are men. So there were no women. I don't know that any of this had anything to do with me not getting sober right away. I just have come to believe it takes whatever it takes, and when the time is right, the time is right. On March the 14th, I had my last drink, and my miracle began for me. I had not intended to have my last drink on that day. It just happened. I'd been going to meetings and drinking and going to meetings and drinking. All kinds of things began to happen for me from that period of time on. I was told about a group called the Clarkston 12-Step Group. It had only been in existence for a few months, but it was a step meeting. And they had only one other step meeting in the city of Atlanta at that time, and it was in the inner city. And this fella from Oklahoma came through, and he just couldn't understand why we didn't have step meetings, and he started a step meeting. And there were about, six or eight old-timers. And so we had a step meeting, and then we would alternate with a tradition meeting. So that was my base when I got sober. There was no doubt in my mind what this thing was about. You know, I went to a group where the old, and we didn't talk much. We were told that we were not to talk in meetings. And if we had any questions, we were to come early and talk to the old-timers, and we were to stay late and talk to the old-timers. But during the meetings, for several months when I first got sober, you did not share in a meeting. You listened. And I listened to these old-timers share about the steps and the traditions. And one of the things that I'm most grateful for today, not only because I got sober, but the time and the circumstances in which I got sober. So my base was so firm from the very beginning. And I had some interesting experiences. Of course, there were no women on that side of town. I had fixed myself a drink one night, and I lifted up the glass, and the bottom of the glass fell out. And the alcohol went all over the thing. And I did not drink that night. I thought maybe I was finally getting a message from my mother. I had been trying to get all those messages. And then on two different occasions, one time I had fixed a drink, and one time I was just thinking about fixing the drink. And there was a gal who had come through from Texas. And she had gotten my name and called me and asked me if I would go to a meeting with her. And I went to a meeting with her on those two occasions. I was out with Al one night, and he was in sales and with a client, and he asked me if I thought I could handle a little something to drink. And I said, yeah, I thought I could handle a little something to drink. And I ordered a drink, and the barmaid came back and said, we're all out of that. And I had been drinking for 20 years, and they had never been all out of that. So I did not drink that night. And the final time for me was over the 4th of July weekend. And we'd had a couple had come down from Baltimore that we had drank with, and they'd been drinking all day long, and I was just irritable, restless, and discontent. And we went to dinner, and I ordered a drink. The barmaid brought it, and I couldn't touch it. I was like stone. I started to cry. I left the table. I went to the restroom, and the girls came with me, and I knew. I knew in my innermost self at that moment. We have a fella in my home group that says he knew there was no good drinking time left. And I knew in my innermost self that I had no more good drinking time left. And I never had another problem of ever knowing who I was and what I was and where I needed to be to get the help that I needed and to learn how to live, which I have learned in this program. So all kinds of things began to happen for me. I just fell in love with AA. I just loved it. I loved the people. I loved the stories. I loved being there with everybody. It was just a wonderful experience, and my life really began to turn around. I had to go to North Atlanta. The guys assured me that they would not sponsor me, so they found me the name of a gal up in North Atlanta, and I called and asked her to meet me and to be my sponsor, and she's still my sponsor today. So I'm one of those fortunate ones. I have the same home group and the same sponsor I've had since I got sober. And she was wonderful. The first thing she suggested that I go home and pray. And I told her that I really didn't believe in prayer, that I had tried it and it hadn't worked. And she told me that she didn't care what I believed, that this is what they had found that worked in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I certainly had nothing to lose. And then she gave me a great piece of freedom. She said, you don't have to believe what I ask you to do. If you'll just do it, you know, you don't have to believe it. You don't have to commit to it. You don't have to. And I mean, I could do it under those circumstances. So I went home, and I was so uncomfortable. I look back at that time and can remember how uncomfortable I was at the thought of doing prayer, and today how uncomfortable I am at the thought of not doing the prayer and the work that I do, you know, when my feet hit the floor in the morning and when I go to bed at night. So I locked the door so nobody would see me, and I got down on my knees and asked God to help me keep sober and help me put my life back together again. And there weren't any burning bushes or anything, but I know as I look back today, my life was never the same from that period of time. And that was the beginning of my reaching out and having some kind of a conscious contact with a power greater than myself. And of course, as I've stayed sober, that has just enhanced and enhanced and enhanced to today. I just have that wonderful conscious contact with God. I think about spiritual things all the time. Sometimes I'm not able to do spiritual things, but I do think about it a lot. And I just love that way of life. And of course, things began to work for me. I got into the steps and started working the steps. And all of a sudden, as my life began to come together, a lot of people I love lives began to really fall apart. The first one being my dad. I don't guess there was a night that he lived with that first year I got sober that he didn't ask me if I didn't want to have a drink with him. And I'd have to say, not tonight, Dad. And he finally decided after a year that I wasn't any fun to live with anymore. And he went back to Florida, and he went on a bad drunk, ended up in the hospital, and I went down there. And the doctors had told him that he was not to have any more drinking either. And we talked about going to AA, and I was so excited to think that I'd get back home and take him to AA. But that was not to be in the plan. The day that I went to pick him up to take him home, they were working on him, and he was gone. I went home very confused and angry and sad. Couldn't understand why I'd been given the gift and it wasn't his to have. And the people in AA held my hand until I got through that period and on the other side of the road, because when I began to understand, therefore, but the grace of God, and really his alcoholism was really none of my business. And I was able to put that to rest, and through a lot of inventorying with my family. Sponsor came over, we burned that box of letters from my mother. I was still having to read them a little bit, and so we did that. And through the steps, I was able to take the wonderful things from the relationship with my mom and dad and to let go of the other stuff and do whatever I needed to do with that stuff. Shortly after that, our middle daughter, Lori, became a runaway. She was a runaway for the better part of 2 years. We'd never had any problems with the children. Al and I loved the children dearly, and it was a very hard time for both of us. We did find her. We had her picked up and put into a committed. We had her committed to a 30-day treatment program. It worked for a while, and then, of course, as we all know, if you're ready, you're ready. If you're not ready, I don't care what you do. There's nothing that's going to work for you. And she wasn't ready, and wasn't ready for many, many years after that. But I was at my home group, and they had asked me to read how it works, and I cried. I couldn't get through it. But I stayed for my business meeting, and as I said, back in those days, short of death, you attended your group's business meeting. So I was there, and one of the old-timers asked me if I'd serve the group as the GSR. And I told him I was real sorry, but I had too many personal problems that I would not be able to serve. And one of the old-timers took me aside and told me about service and how good it would be for me, and especially when times were really sad for me, it would really give me a wonderful opportunity to lose myself into something constructive, and they were really right. And I bought the idea, and I served my group as GSR and went on to serve in the local area, and then had the wonderful opportunity to be delegate of the state of Georgia, served with Jim when he was delegate of the state of Alabama, a wonderful time, and went on just recently to have served 4 years as the Southeast Regional Trustee. And the experience has just been an awesome thing. The opportunity to study at that level of service with the traditions and the concepts has just been something that I would not have missed. It has been an awesome experience. I had an opportunity to attend the World Service Meeting. And, you know, I get so excited about what has transpired in my life since I've gotten sober. And it has been wonderful, wonderful to be involved in watching what has happened with Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, we're just 62 years old, and this message is carried in 142 countries outside of the U.S. and Canada. And our literature has been translated into 61 languages and dialects, which is phenomenal for being 62 years old. That's why I hope I will always be a responsible member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our long form of our first tradition says, if AA does not live, most of us will surely die. And I believe that, and I believe that as a responsible member of AA, it's up to me to do everything to make sure that I don't ever do anything that hurts this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. Shortly after Lori, our daughter, I came home from work one day and there was a letter from my 15-year-old daughter that she'd run off and married her drug dealer. And it was a devastating time again. It lasted about a year. She came home a full-fledged drug addict, and the stealing and the lying was so bad. And Al and I were spending all our spare time up on Memorial Drive trying to get all our stuff back that she had pawned. And so it came, we counseled with some people, and they suggested that we put her out, and we did. We packed her in two garbage sacks and put her on the street, and it was the most difficult day of my sobriety. And when she did get to Narcotics Anonymous, and on her first birthday, I had an opportunity to give her her chip, she said that had been the beginning of her recovery, the fact that we had, Al and I began to learn a whole new way of loving our kids, a way of loving our kids that wasn't help hurting them anymore, and that was really a new experience. I am constantly, I find it so interesting that my old ideas, even as I stay sober, continue to crop out about what I think is the way things are. And then I think it's the wonderful thing about working the steps. I mean, that changes. You begin to find out more about yourself and more about those old ideas. And I have just been engulfed with old ideas, and a few of them have reared their ugly heads lately. And just an opportunity to do some more work and becoming, I hope, the person that God really intends for me to be. Allison made it to Narcotics Anonymous. She doesn't go to meetings anymore, and we know pretty much that she's in trouble. I was 5 years sober, and Al was not getting any better. I mean, the FBI was still there, the IRS was still there, and all kinds of things were happening. I got up one morning with a great freedom that I knew that I didn't have to make this marriage work anymore. And my sponsor and I went to see a lawyer, and we took out papers. And the day before Al was to sign the papers, he ended up in the Augusta Medical Center with what they thought was a heart attack. And the doctor told me that he didn't need any stress and strain, and I was not happy. I had made up my mind which way I was going, and all of a sudden, I really believe if you have taken that third step and you've turned your life and will over the care of God as you understand Him, and you make a decision that's not good for you, it will be reversed. And there was a series of things that began to happen, and this decision got reversed. I told Al he could come home and stay until the insurance paid his medical claim. Because I was the one who had the insurance. And I don't know why I didn't know that the insurance would have paid the medical claim anyway. But some things, wonderful things began to happen for us. A very wise AA person told him to leave me alone, let me do whatever I needed to do and give me my space. And then it might be a good idea that he got himself back into Al-Anon, which he did. And he'll tell you more about that tomorrow. And a wonderful thing began to happen after, you know, that silent scorn went on for a while. We began to sort of communicate a little bit, and we've learned how to have a relationship, and we're still working on it. We learned how to respect each other and give each other a little space and support each other and get a little of ourselves aside sometimes when it's for the good of the whole. And it's been quite an experience, and I'm really grateful now. We'll have 40 years of marriage next year, and that's pretty unusual. I'm really glad that is our story, because that is not the story for a lot of people, and I'm really glad that it has worked out for us that way. The other thing that I want to share with you is one of the most wonderful miracles that has happened for me is that I am a jazz pianist, and I don't have to tell you where I have to go to work. And when I first got sober, I tried to go back to work a couple times, and I had an agreement with my sponsor. If it worked for me, if it didn't interfere with my sobriety, that I would be okay. And of course, I didn't drink, but I was getting caught up in that, mesmerized in that camaraderie, as Bill calls it, with that, the total picture, the bar room and the music and the lights and the whole thing, the music, and I couldn't do it. About 10 years ago, I wanted to try it again, and I had the blessing of my family and my sponsors and my sponsorees, and I went back and went down to Underground and auditioned for the jazz club down there, and I've been working there ever since, and it has worked out just wonderfully. My feet were on firm ground. I knew I had a reason to be there. You know, that's where my talents are expressed, and I know that that's God's territory just as much as this is God's territory. So a wonderful thing for me, something I never thought would be possible, and it happened for me. I'm so grateful for the opportunities that I've had since I've been sober. I love being sober. There's a guy in my home group that says if I could have written down on a list what I wanted when I walked through the doors, it would have been so different than what I have found here. And I'm very grateful to you all for helping me find that. I like to close with something that's real important to me, and it's my favorite thing that's said about AA, and I believe it, and I've not been able to find anything I like as well. And it's called In All Our Affairs. It says the chief purpose of AA is sobriety. We all realize that without sobriety, we have nothing. However, it is possible to expand this simple aim into a great deal of nonsense so far as the individual member is concerned. Sometimes we hear him say, in effect, sobriety is my sole responsibility. After all, I'm a pretty fine chap, except for my drinking. Give me sobriety and I've got it made. As long as our friend clings to this comfortable alibi, he will make so little progress with his real-life problems and responsibilities that he stands in a fair way to get drunk again. This is why AA's 12th step urges that we practice these principles in all our affairs. We are not living just to be sober. We are living to learn, to serve, and to love. And I love each of you all, and I thank you for my sobriety.